United States versus McIntosh, 20-5089. Counsel, we are ready when you are.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Bolin of the firm of Bolin and Shaw, and I appear on behalf of appellant John Michael McIntosh. Mr. McIntosh showed up to his change of plea hearing, and he told the court that he hadn't received necessary mental health medication. And as a result, he couldn't exercise proper judgment. He wasn't in a right state of mind. He didn't understand what was really going on at the hearing, and that he was flip-flopping, essentially, that he couldn't decide whether to plead guilty or not plead guilty. He couldn't make a proper decision on that issue. The district court ignored these comments. Instead, the conversation turned to the adequacy of the library at the jail, and the court never rehabilitated Mr. McIntosh on any of these points. The court should have followed up on them. The court was required, before accepting a plea, to ensure that Mr. McIntosh was knowingly and voluntarily pleading guilty to the charged crimes. I'd like to pause for a moment and go to the competency evaluation process. The government seems to make much of the fact that there was a competency evaluation early in this case and that Mr. McIntosh was found competent to stand trial. But being competent to stand trial is a very different thing from having the state of mind necessary in order to be able to plead guilty to charges knowingly and voluntarily.
What evidence do you have of that? That those are two different tests, that you would need different evidence of competency and a higher level of competency to plead guilty than you would need to stand trial?
So the standard of competency, Judge Ebell, is whether a defendant has the state of mind such that he can assist his lawyer in his defense and understand the nature of the proceedings and the charges against him. He's not required to be able to make a conscious decision about risks and rewards in litigation. In fact, most of the strategy calls in the actual trial are for the lawyer, not for the client. The client is only required to be able to assist in the defense and understand what's going on in terms of the nature of the charges against him. But to the contrary, the Constitution and, of course, Rule 11 all require a lot of steps to ensure that a defendant is fully aware of what's going on at the plea hearing. He needs to be able to knowingly and voluntarily plead guilty. And why is that? It's because he is giving up important trial protections. If a defendant is merely competent to stand trial, he still goes to a trial where he puts the government to its burden of proof. He has a jury of his peers who decides his case. He is able to have an attorney confront witnesses against him, and he is able to choose whether to testify or not without consequence and without inference. But what he does when he pleads guilty is he gives up all of those important trial protections. So there must be an assurance during the plea hearing that he is knowingly and voluntarily doing so. And that's what the Rule 11 colloquy is. It's a lengthy and detailed colloquy where the court is required to assure itself that the defendant is in a state of mind where he can understand and does understand and is voluntarily giving up all of those important protections.
The court did ask those specific questions of this defendant. The court said, do you understand the charges, don't they? At least the court made a finding that he understood those charges. Did the court specifically ask, do you understand the charges against you?
Yes, Your Honor. There were general statements where Mr. McIntosh indicated he understood the charges and he understood the plea agreement.
Are you arguing then that the court should not accept the defendant's statement, but have a new hearing, a new kind of a level of competency hearing to say that I do understand the charges in the plea?
No, Your Honor, there's not necessarily a competency hearing because it's not the judge's role to facilitate that plea agreement. The judge is merely playing the neutral arbiter here. And if a defendant is competent to come in and knowingly and voluntarily plead, the court can accept the plea. if there's a question about that, a serious question, as there was in this case, the court should be telling the parties, okay, I'm going to continue this hearing. And if and when you can bring me a defendant who wants to plead guilty and is of a state of mind where he can plead guilty, great. Otherwise, we go to trial, where all those trial protections are there to protect the defendant who's competent to stand trial, but may not be competent to give a knowing and voluntary plea.
Isn't that exactly what this court did a couple times when he said, fine, we're going to wait a minute. You're going to have a conference with your attorney and with the government. And didn't the court do that twice?
That's where we get into the voluntariness argument, Your Honor, because the court didn't just say the court is a neutral arbiter and I will continue this hearing and you all can come back when the defendant is in a better state of mind. The court instead, on the record, told the government that it could speak with Mr. McIntosh, and the government convinced Mr. McIntosh to plead guilty. And then when Mr. McIntosh came back on the record,
well, we don't know that statement of yours. We don't know who convinced Mr. McIntosh because there's no transcript of those conversations. But I assume that Mr. McIntosh's attorney was present during them. Isn't that correct?
Every indication from the record indicates that it appears so. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But then everyone came back on the record. And the district court added its approval and encouragement to the decision.
Well, only after the defendant said he would take the plea. And the district court then said, well, you know, if it makes you feel any better, I think you're making a good decision or something to that effect. The district court didn't actually go participate in the discussion about whether the defendant should take the plea. District no. court said after the decision was made, in fact, both times the district court opined was after the defendant said, I'm going to take the plea. And the court said, yeah, I mean, by doing it, you're saving yourself 10 years. So probably a good decision.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. The court waited until after Mr. McIntosh came back and said, quote, I'll just take the deal in apparent resignation.
In Mr. McIntosh's first comment when he walked in was that it's too much time. I mean, he was unhappy with 25 years? I'm not quite sure, but he was unhappy with the length of time he was getting under the plea agreement. Not surprisingly, was vacillating a little bit about whether to accept the deal. I don't think that when someone's having difficulty deciding whether they should plead guilty doesn't necessarily mean that when they finally resolve that conflict that they didn't do it voluntarily or knowingly.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. However, there was more here than just vacillating between the guilty plea and not guilty plea. This defendant showed up saying he wasn't receiving necessary medication and that his judgment was impaired and that he couldn't make a proper decision. That's when the trial court should have stopped. Going back to the trial court's—
But his own counsel said, I think he's perfectly competent, right? His own counsel didn't see any problem. Is that correct?
I believe there were comments like that, but they were after Mr. McIntosh had been cajoled into agreeing to this deal. And after the trial court had added its approval and encouragement of that decision. So by that time, given the fragile mental state that Mr. McIntosh said he was in at the beginning, those comments certainly could have risen to the level of coercion under the law. And nobody faults the district court here. There's no doubt that the court believed this was the best thing for Mr. McIntosh to do. And it appears that everyone was likely acting out of benevolence in trying to convince him to take this deal because it did decrease the mandatory minimum sentences that he was involved in. But our system doesn't allow coercion, even if it is for good intent, and even if pleading guilty is the best result for a particular defendant. To the contrary, our system puts the defendants through a trial and provides them with substantial trial protections and only if a defendant is of a state of mind where he can knowingly and voluntarily waive all those protections and plead guilty, do we accept guilty pleas.
Counsel, can I jump in there? Can you help me understand what is your argument as to knowingly and what is your argument to voluntarily? I mean, are you separating those two prongs, and tell me what the evidence you're relying on, if you are separating them, because you've said knowing and voluntarily, and I know those phrases go together, but if you could pull that, those two components out for me, that would be great.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. They do go very closely together in this case. I would say that knowingly is in the sense that he didn't have the mental capacity at the time to actually weigh the pros and cons of the decision. He said that he didn't understand what was going on and he couldn't make the decision. And I would say that the voluntary argument relies more on the pressure, as Mr. McIntosh put it in his motion to withdraw the guilty plea. The environment was such that it pressured him into this guilty plea. And the two are actually very closely related in this case, because
the problem is if we were to say the pressure of pleading guilty and therefore taking 20 years in jail or something is so much that it affects voluntariness, that basically guts every plea deal. We've said in other decisions that it is a pressure point. It isn't a point of some ambiguity and some doubt Nobody very happily or knowingly agrees to go 20 years in jail. That pressure is unavoidable. And if that pressure is sufficient to override voluntariness, we just throw the agreement out the window.
You're absolutely right about that, Judge Ebell. And that's not the type of pressure I'm talking about. I'm talking about the type of pressure exerted by the government with the imprimatur of the court.
The thing is, we don't know. The whole problem there is we have no idea what pressure the government exercised, because those conversations were not recorded. There's no transcript in the record on it. All we know is that he had his attorney there. So we can make no presumptions about whether or if the government applied any pressure.
The motion to withdraw the guilty plea mentions that the government was discussing in general terms the importance of the guilty plea and the dire consequences if Mr. McIntosh did not plead guilty. But I do want to reassure the court that we're not asking the court to overturn in all situations where there is pressure applied by the government or where there is the imprimatur, the approval and encouragement of the court. We're only asking this court to recognize that Mr. McIntosh had already told the court that because he wasn't receiving necessary mental health medication, he couldn't make a proper judgment. And so under those circumstances, that kind of pressure from the government and government actors can overcome his will. That may not happen with someone with a mind of steel, but someone who's not getting his mental health medication.
Well, I'm going to stop you. The record doesn't say mental health medication. It says medication. There's nothing that indicates what the medication was for. There's nothing in that that hearing that tells us what his condition is. I mean, I think you're presuming a lot that I don't see in the record.
I understand the question, Your Honor, and I think this court can infer that it was mental health medication, or at the very least some medication that would affect his ability, his mental state, because that's what he says. Because he's not getting the medication, he can't exercise proper judgment. And in addition, the court knew about his mental health issues, having read the competency evaluation and gone through the competency hearing system. If there are no other questions at this time, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Herney?
May it please the court, counsel, Eleanor Herney for the United States. Mr. McIntosh has established neither that his guilty plea was constitutionally invalid, nor that the district court erred in denying his motion to withdraw. Indeed, while Mr. McIntosh focuses on his counseled conversations with the United States and the brief statement at the outset of the plea hearing, the facts, in light of the record as a whole, fail to contradict his sworn statements to the contrary.
Well, let me just start with the statement at the beginning that says, I'm not on my medication, so I can't make a decision. But what, that's a statement that I can't make a decision. What do you do with that?
Your Honor, what the district court did in this case was, after placing Mr. McIntosh under oath, conducted a thorough Rule 11 colloquy during which it asked him about his understanding. It turned to his attorneys to ask whether there were any concerns about his competence, and it exercised its judgment in light of its observations of his demeanor, his behavior, and the record as a whole to determine that Mr. McIntosh did, in fact, understand the proceedings. The fact that he was having a difficult time deciding didn't mean that.
I think it's not, he's saying it's not just a difficult time to decide. He's not saying, oh, this is just such a hard decision. He's saying, I can't make the decision because I am not on my medication.
Your Honor, I believe that the record does not reflect that there was necessary mental health medication. As an initial matter, the only statement supporting that there was some medication to be required was raised during this brief statement at the outset of the hearing, and it was not raised again, even when an inquiry was made about his mental status, his ability to understand.
Well, in fairness, Mr. Boland points out, there'd been a competency hearing here, and there was a report from that review of his mental state that did have information about his mental health issues.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. And it noted, based on Mr. McIntosh's report, that he had previously been prescribed several mental health medications. However, ultimately, the report itself did not include any diagnoses or continued prescriptions, so the record is undeveloped on that point. Instead, he was diagnosed, I believe, with malingering and several substance abuse disorders.
The problem I have is you're grouping the understanding of the question with and equating it to competency to make a decision. I think those are two very different questions. And I think that the court could say, yeah, you understand the decision, you are competent, but are you able to make a decision? And that's the prong that I think is the more uncertain in this case.
Certainly, Your Honor, and there is a distinction between competence and knowing, although it was not preserved in this case necessarily.
Certainly it's been preserved that he was in a fragile state of mind. He announced that to the court, and the court didn't do anything to explore what was causing his fragile state of mind.
Mr. McIntosh did announce at the outset of the hearing that his mental state was in some way not strong. However, the district court, in light of the record as a whole, including reviewing the competency evaluations, which include psychological observations that can apply outside of the competency realm if we're talking about legal competency, and its knowledge of the defendant as a whole, as well as the follow-up questions regarding whether or not he can understand the proceedings and the observations of both federal public defenders that were present to determine that Mr. McIntosh was able to proceed. Proceed to my next point. And again, a plea in this context to be knowing, it has to have been, to be valid, it has to have been an intelligent choice amongst the alternatives available to the defendant. And in this case, his choices were either to plead blind to the indictment, which carried at least 35 years of incarceration, to proceed to trial and risk at least 35 years, possibly more, depending upon whether or not the victims testified in a way that might aggravate sentencing, or to take the certain decision of a 25-year binding agreement.
And I don't think there's any anybody here today who thinks that he would have been better off going to trial, but I don't think that's the issue. The issue is whether when he said, I'm not on my meds, and I just don't feel like my judgment is right. You know what I'm saying? Whether that was enough to put an obligation on the court to explore that.
No, Your Honor. In light of the record as a whole, including the findings in the competency evaluation, as well as the judge's observations in the first instance of Mr. McIntosh, and following the questions after, the district court had enough information to conclude that Mr. McIntosh was able to proceed.
You know, we keep making murky the difference. I do think it's clear that he understood. The question is, was he able to be competent to make a decision? He said he wasn't, and the court just let it drop. The court didn't probe it. The court didn't say, why aren't you? And he says, because of the meds. The court could have said, what meds? He could have said, because the government's pressuring. The court could have said, if you're worried about being pressured, you better have some meetings with your lawyer, not with the presence of the U.S. attorney, and probe it further. I mean, it was so perfunctory of this court on the competency to make a decision when the testimony was, I am not competent to make a decision.
Your Honor, I hate to sound like a broken record, but going back to the record as a whole and this court's understanding of the defendant's prior behaviors underlying the competency evaluation, it was well within the court's discretion to determine that he was competent to proceed at that point. And further,
what do you mean by the defendant's behaviors? You said they look at the record of the whole and the defendant's behaviors up to this point. What are you referring to?
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize for the lack of specificity. Turning specifically to the competency evaluation within the psychiatrist, the person performing the evaluation, noted that they conducted examinations of his behavior both in the presence of psychological staff and outside of the presence, and determined, for example, that while he claimed to lack legal knowledge and just general knowledge, he was also observed on the phone informing someone that he couldn't talk about his wheeling and dealing because they record the conversations. This information, which supported a diagnosis in this report of malingering, was something that was known and within the record before the district court. If I may, I will proceed to voluntariness.
It's fine.
Briefly, again, as previously discussed, of the three options that were available to the defendant, none were what you would call good. All carried a serious prison term as a result of the preceding conduct. And the fact that the defendant felt pressure, as was previously discussed, is not sufficient to obviate voluntariness. In Sanchez Leon, this court noted that even if we were to assume that the defendant, in that case, was surprised, scared, or pressured by a last-minute plea offer or strong statements by counsel, that isn't enough to constitute coercion that vitiates voluntariness. There is a pressure that is inherent, as was previously identified, in plea proceedings. And in this case, it certainly does not rise to the level that has been identified and accepted in other cases. For example, in Carr, where the defendant described himself as being browbeaten. While this may have been a difficult decision for him to make, and I am sure that it was, he is a young man who is facing a substantial prison term. That doesn't mean that it was not his decision to make, just that it was an incredibly difficult one. Finally, turning to the issue of the motion to withdraw the plea, in this case, the defendant presented in the actual motion to withdraw a single reason, or at least clearly, the knowing involuntariness of his plea. He did not address and has never addressed actual innocence, nor was effective assistance of counsel ever clearly raised. And as in the Muhammad case, where the defendant does not raise all of these factors or address the factors before the district court, the circuit court need not address them in further detail either. They can be found to be waived. And as that is the case here, we would ask that the court affirm the district court. And if there are no further questions.
Seeing none.
None here.
Thank you. And I can't remember, Mr. Boland, if you have, oh yes, you have a minute. There you go. You're muted.
Excuse me. In light of our argument.
Eloquent.
Thank you. In light of our argument in the briefing before this court, we would ask that the court enforce the district court's obligations to ensure that defendants are knowingly and voluntarily entering into these plea agreements that waive their substantial constitutional rights. And so therefore, we would ask that the court reverse the judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Let me ask you a question. Yep. What exactly do you think the court should have done? If we write an opinion your way, we're going to have to say to the court, you were deficient. We probably have to suggest what the court should have done.
Yes.
What the court should have done other than twice referring him back to his lawyer and twice saying, talk to the attorney, the government again, if you want. What more should the court have done?
Because the defendant stated that medication was the reason that he couldn't make a judgment, the court needed to inquire into that further with some specificity. I see my time is up. May I finish answering the question?
Yes, please do.
So questions like what medication, what condition, how does that affect your judgment? Is the fact, would medication make it so that you could properly plead at a future date? Those kinds of questions were never asked, and they must be.
What if he said, gosh, I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I can't tell you whether I could ever make a decision. This is so much pressure and I'm so young. I can't tell you that I would ever be able to competently make a decision and weigh the pros and cons. Then what does the district court do?
Then the district court ought to continue the hearing until such time as Mr. McIntosh arrives and says, those issues with my medication are over and I am now able to make a decision.
So you're basically telling us that the court could hold him indefinitely without a trial and without a plea because he may not ever come to that position that he could make a decision competently for that very hard decision. There are plenty of people out there, some of which are criminally inclined, who simply have trouble making decisions and may never reach that. So are we telling those people you get a free pass, but not really free because you're going to be held without trial forever? We've got a conundrum here and we've got to find a practical solution to it.
No, Your Honor, if a defendant is competent to stand trial.
At that point, are you saying we should have told the court, pull the trigger and go forward with the trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, do you think it factors into as you said, this was a benevolent situation on the part of, you've got a guy's facing at least 35 years if he goes to trial and has a plea that's taken a substantial reduction on that. I mean, surely you don't want the district court judge to say, nope, that's it. We're going to go to trial and take your chances. I mean, the district court is really in a difficult position here under these circumstances. But I'm not sure keeping him indefinitely giving him an opportunity to say when he might be ready to consider the plea, or sending him immediately to trial are really great options here.
I agree, Your Honor, and I think we have to go with what the law says. And the law says that a defendant can only plead guilty if it can be knowing and voluntary. Otherwise, if the defendant is competent to stand trial, then you go to trial. And then the defendant enjoys all of the constitutional trial protections that we all love of this great country without waiving them, even if that may or may not be the best thing for him in the moment.
Okay, thank you. Since we let you go 3 minutes over, I'm going to offer Ms. Hernley, if you would like to take some time to respond.
No, Your Honor, we would rest on the briefs.
Okay, thank you. We will take this matter under advisement.